Please turn to John chapter 18. I will be reading verses 28 through 40. John 18 and verses 28 through 40. Then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. So Pilate went outside to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" They answered him, "If this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you." Pilate said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him by your own law." The Jews said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." This was to fulfill the word that Jesus had spoken to show by what kind of death he was going to die. So Pilate entered his headquarters again and called Jesus and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered, "Do you say this of your own accord, or did others say it to you about me?" Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you over to me." "What have I done?" Jesus answered. "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting, that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world." Then Pilate said to him, "So you are a king?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" After he had said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, "I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" They cried out again, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. Jesus, here in this context, at this time, in John chapter 18, is a threat to the social order of this day. The leaders are busily hustling him around, moving about through the dark, seeking to get a conviction resulting in capital punishment. They want him to be removed. They want the problem of Jesus of Nazareth to be no more. And they seek to do that by bringing him forward to the Roman authorities and bringing about a capital punishment leading to death upon the cross. And they have reasons, I believe, for doing that. See, but Jesus here is a very unique criminal. And as these proceedings continue on, up even into his death upon the cross and his resurrection thereafter, and even the influence he will have upon the world in the years happening afterwards, demonstrate that he is a very, very unique person in this situation. They are pressing all of their might to bring a conviction upon him, pressing all of their might to have the guilty verdict brought down so that he can be placed under the authority of the Roman authorities and be put to death. And they've been in such a hurry to do this that they forgot to adequately even bring together the charges whereby he would be brought forward to demonstrate that he violated the law, whereby deserving death upon the cross. What is the crime that he is committing? What is the turmoil that is happening? It is Jesus here who is standing against these false religions of his day, false religions of his day, which are not too different from the many false religions which we have within our day. These idols, these areas of trust that we place ourselves under, these things that we say, "You are my Lord, deliver me. Here I will place my trust at this time." Jesus is a threat to all of these. His mere presence at this time is a threat to this religious and social order that exists at this time. And so the desire of the Jewish authorities is for him to be removed. the desire will be of the Roman authorities likewise for him to be removed. There are three religions that I want to point out that we see in this passage, and they may not be religions in the classical sense of religion, but they are religions in the fact that men are trusting in these. They are a means whereby men are trusting in this as opposed to trusting in the sovereign Lord Jesus Christ. And the existence of Jesus to them at this time demonstrates that he needs to be removed if they cannot both serve here as Lord. The mere existence of Christ is an offense to all who are trusting in these religions. Three religions that I bring forward to you is the religion of self-righteousness, the religion of relativism, and thirdly, the religion of pragmatism. Self-righteousness, relativism, and pragmatism. First, the religion of self-righteousness. This religion is one where a man will pick and choose that which he follows in order to make himself just, in order to make himself feel just. Because the truth is, as you will talk to a man that follows a religion of self-righteousness, he will declare to you, well, nobody is perfect. All of us make mistakes. All of us sin. And him knowing that within his conscience and him desiring to justify himself anyway, what that man will do is he will pick and he will choose that which he follows, and he will look on others that do not follow the same method that he uses, and he will think higher of himself. He will justify himself because someone is not following in the same way that he is. See, this religion is one that emphasizes the outside of the cup, as Jesus would talk to the Pharisees. They would clean the outside of the cup, but they would neglect this inner part of the cup, which is where they really needed to be cleaned. And this desire to affect this outside ends up affecting even that outside, that the inside is not cleaned. And so such people end up committing incredible acts of sin. And we see that in this passage. Number two, we see the religion of relativism, this religion that places man as sovereign, this religion that says that man is the epicenter of all truth, that inner toddler in all of us that makes ourselves the center, that makes ourselves the one whereby we can be the judge and the jury and the legislature that creates the law, ourselves being that which is sovereign. A religion that allows men to emphasize morals in one circumstance, in one way, and then act in a completely different way over here. And the reason is, this is truth for me in this instance, and over here, it does not truth. Thirdly, we see the religion of pragmatism. Religion of pragmatism, whose bedfellows are self-preservation and utilitarianism. The religion of pragmatism seeks to do that which is most advantageous to the person at the time, which would be self-preservation, or to a particular group of people at a time, which would be utilitarianism. The religion of pragmatism can parade as Christianity at times. It can look very much like a Christian religion if you don't get too much past the service. If you stand at a distance and look, it can look very similar, and the pragmatist will practice a facade of Christianity when it is most beneficial to him in that particular cultural context. But as soon as that is not necessary, as soon as it is not advantageous to parade as a Christian in that cultural context, there will be a change. Because ultimately, number one is what is number one. And the religion of Christianity can parade as that which is righteous and holy at this time, and then can turn on a dime and crucify an innocent man when that becomes more advantageous to them. See the words of Paul in 1 Corinthians 2:6. He says, yet among the mature, we do impart wisdom, although it is not a wisdom of this age or of the rulers of this age who are doomed to pass away. These religions fall into this category of which Paul writes, that which is passing away, the idol of self-righteousness. The idol of relativism, that I get to determine that which is truth, and the idol of pragmatism are passing away. And though for a moment they may offer you a glimpse of hope, in the end they will be defeated ultimately and have been defeated within the cross of Jesus Christ. So number one, we see this religion of self-righteousness, which is something we have seen throughout the Gospel of John as Jesus has been dealing with the Jewish leaders. We see that beginning in John 18 in verse 28, where it says, then they led Jesus from the house of Caiaphas to the governor's headquarters. It was early in the morning. They themselves did not enter the governor's headquarters so that they would not be defiled, but could eat the Passover. The Jewish leaders believed that they would be able to just send Jesus to Pilate. They believed that this was going to be an open and closed case, that they were going to just bring him forward to Pilate's house, and right then and there he would take him, and then he would be executed immediately. You see that? They don't even bring a charge. Pilate asks them, what is the charge that you are bringing against this man? And their response is one that's just such a logical fallacy, is it not? It is one where they are appealing to their own position, appealing to their own authority, not giving any demonstration as to why this man is guilty. They say this, if this man were not doing evil, we would not have delivered him over to you. I wish they didn't really answer the question, now did they? What is it that he did? If he hadn't done anything, we would not have brought him to you. They hadn't even thought through the charges. They assumed that since Pilate had allowed them to take with them a band of soldiers and had allowed them to arrest Jesus, that this would be open and close. But Pilate was not operating in this way. Instead, you have a very unique trial happening at Pilate's headquarters. It's one where the charge don't even occupy the same room as the ones who are charging don't even occupy the same room as the one who is charged. They don't even enter the residence of the one to whom they're hoping will make this judgment for them. And why? What is this reason that they would not enter this house of Pilate? Because they don't want to be ceremonially unclean. Now, I've read the Old Testament, and I don't remember coming across a passage in there that says merely entering the house of a Gentile would make you unclean, but the Mishnah does state that, which is a commentary on the law that the Jews would use at this time, and it's because of so much uncleanness that would have existed there, so many ways in which this household, that there could have been bodies that were buried under the household, something that pagans would do. There could have been furniture made out of unclean animals. There would have been food and drink offered to you, perhaps, that was unclean, and so it just becomes easier just to put the fence up and say, okay, if you go in there, you're going to be unclean because there's so much that these Gentiles are doing in their households that is ceremonially unclean that we just need to go on the side of being careful at that time. But remember, it's not uncommon for Jews to enter the houses of Gentiles at this time. They had to interact with Gentiles. Gentiles were ruling over them. Gentiles were people that they needed, in all honesty, to be doing business with. So they would go into the house of a Gentile and just be ceremonially unclean for the day. They would go and they would give their sacrifice. They would take their bath for the day, and then they would be clean the very next day. This wasn't a serious form of uncleanliness, but the Jewish leaders did not want to be seen publicly as unclean. That's my opinion here. I believe that's the rationale behind this. These are people that are seen in very high positions during these festivals, and they don't want to be seen as someone who is unclean that has to step away from these Passover celebrations during these next following days. And so Pilate is having to walk out here and talk to the accusers, and then walk back into his house here, and then talk to the accused, and then walk back over here. And I believe John is giving to us just one of his many Johannian ironies, showing the great irony that exists here. He is intentionally showing them to be a people who are violating their own law. They, as we demonstrated in the last sermon, they violated their own civil law at this time period that had been laid down. Just a few examples that I want to review. Jesus had been arrested without proper charges. He had been arrested based upon the witness of an accomplice that had been bribed, not allowed. Next, he was being tried at night. Capital crimes had to be tried during the day, very open. So none of these things would be rushed. The proceedings were held the day before a feast. You were not to hold a trial before a feast for a capital crime, because once again, this is a civil law that very much was written for the purpose of not accusing someone and convicting someone who was innocent. So capital punishment was very, very difficult under the Jewish law. Jesus is also being directly examined and called upon to testify himself, something that was not allowed. They were to go out and bring in witnesses that would come in and make this testimony. They were to go out and to bring in witnesses that would testify for the one that was accused. None of that is happening here. A very, very biased court, which is what we see in this circumstance. And that is just the civil law. That is just how this court proceeding should have happened. The irony is also here that not only were they concerned with not violating this law that we can only find in the Mishnah, they're also not concerned with violating the moral law of God, which we see so many times described in the scriptures as that which is weightier, that which has greater weight, that which is of greater importance. Just go over a couple of them. The 10th commandment, do not covet. They coveted Jesus. Pilate even noticed this, that they were envious of Jesus. That says that in Matthew chapter 27. 9th commandment, bearing false witness. There is continual bearing false witness in the ways in which these trials are happening. They are seeking not to find the truth, but rather they are seeking to go and gather for themselves witnesses who are going to go forward and say that which they desire to say, because they have already determined that which should happen within this trial. There's no desire for the truth here. And lastly, the one I'll name is the 6th commandment, do not murder. Clearly being violated, this legal system that existed to preserve life because of this, the positive aspect of the 6th commandment, which is do not murder. Therefore, we should be preserving life. Therefore, we want to make sure that we're not putting someone who is innocent to death. Therefore, we're going to make sure we don't hurry our trials. We're going to make sure that the witnesses that we bring forward have legitimate testimonies. We're going to make sure that we don't arrest people without making proper charges against them. And we're going to operate these trials in such a way that they have sufficient time to work through these truths, to see that which is true. And here they are, putting such great emphasis on this ceremonial cleanliness so that they can participate in this feast of unleavened bread, so that they can be seen and proudly parading amongst the many Jews that will be in town during this time, but yet they're neglecting these laws that are of greater weight. These laws, dear friends, that were written by the very hand of God, but yet they were careful to keep their own traditions. John Calvin says this, they do not consider that they carry more pollution within their hearts than they can contract by entering any place, however profane, and carry to excess their care about smaller matters and neglect what is of highest importance. Isn't that what we've seen Jesus accusing them of throughout the Gospels? Like in Matthew chapter 23, beginning in verse 23, where Jesus says, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you tithe mint and dill and cumin and have neglected the weightier matters of the law, justice and mercy and faithfulness. These you ought to have done without neglecting the others. You blind guides, straining out the gnat and swallowing a camel. Woe to you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you clean the outside of the cup and the plate, but inside they are full of greed and self-indulgence. You blind Pharisee, first clean the inside of the cup and the plate, that the outside may also be clean. This is the religion of self-righteousness. This is the religion that a man focuses on what he can do. I can stand outside of this house. By standing outside of this house, this makes me someone who is more holier than this person over here. But oh, dear friend, to look at the inside. Oh, dear friend, to examine the hearts. There you see that which is influencing the fruit that is coming out in this passage, this self-indulgence, this envy that they have over Jesus and the influence that he has with these people that are here. And so the self-righteous man sets up for himself a righteousness that he can attain, and it is so much lower than the bar that exists in the moral law of God, in the true righteousness, and that righteousness that was demonstrated through Jesus Christ, the one who is the second Adam. Paul says this in Romans 10, 1 through 4, speaking of men such as these in this passage. Brothers, my heart's desire and prayer to God is for them, that they may be saved. For I bear them witness that they have a zeal for God, but not in accordance with knowledge. For being ignorant of the righteousness of God and seeking to establish their own, they did not submit to God's righteousness. For Christ is the end of the law of righteousness to everyone who believes. Jesus is the end of self-righteousness. Faith in Jesus Christ requires a recognition of your own sin. Not just you make mistakes. Not just I'm not as good as I can be. And certainly not one that says, you know, I know I'm not perfect, but at least I didn't do this. So far from the true mark that is given in the law of God, written by the hand of God, that is demonstrated through the life of Jesus Christ, setting up a righteousness of their own, a comfortable one, one that makes them feel good the way that I dress, the people that I'm around, the music that I listen to. There are many things that perhaps you shouldn't be listening to. There are perhaps movies that you shouldn't watch, but our righteousness is never a righteousness that says, well, at least for me and my family, we aren't doing these things as these people over here are doing. You're missing the weightier things of the law. You have a people here who have been blessed by God in so many ways, saved from slavery in Egypt, placed in this promised land, who completely miss the point of the Passover, completely have the Passover lamb standing before them, and he is being rejected so that their superficial view of what the Passover is, which is merely, I have done these particular things, therefore I can do these particular actions. I have done this on my own. Is completely missed. They miss the idea of cleansing out the old leaven, something that had been done during this time period. They had gone through their houses and removed all the leaven that existed, but the leaven in their hearts was still there, and it was growing in great unrighteousness. Paul reminds us of this as we read this so oftentimes in 1 Corinthians 5, 7 through 8. He says, cleanse out the old leaven that you may be a new lump as you are unleavened. For Christ, our Passover lamb, has been sacrificed. Let us therefore celebrate the festival, not with the old leaven, the leaven of malice and evil, but with the unleavened bread of sincerity and truth. This Passover, which was a remembrance of the salvation the Lord had given them and the change they were supposed to be, the distinctiveness they were supposed to be from those that are around them and the distinctiveness they were supposed to be from the place where they came from. They're falling into very similar sins because they are trusting in their efforts. They're trusting in their righteousness, and the true Lamb of God, the true Passover Lamb, stands before them, and he is rejected because he is an affront to the religion of self-righteousness. We see this religion of self-righteousness that the Jewish leaders practiced, that they cling to, that they trusted in, that was their salvation. We also see here the religion of relativism. John 18, verses 36 and 37. Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would have been fighting that I might not be delivered over to the Jews. But my kingdom is not from this world. Then Pilate said to him, so are you a king? Jesus answered, you say that I am a king. For this purpose I was born, and for this purpose I have come into the world, to bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said to him, what is truth? Moral relativism is something that has greatly influenced our society. But those that practice relativism don't often see the tyranny that it leads to, don't see the ways in which relativism ultimately leads to death. Death even for those that are proponents of this relativism. Pilate asks Jesus this question, so are you a king? Jesus here is controlling this trial. Just as Jesus was sovereign in the Garden of Gethsemane, he was sovereign when he was standing before Annas. He is sovereign here as he is standing before Pilate. Are you a king? What do you mean by king? He's basically asking him here to define this word. He's pushing it back to Pilate. What do you mean by king? Who's asking this question? Am I a king like a Caesar in Rome? Am I a king like the Messiah who has been prophesied? If you say I'm one like Caesar, absolutely not. My kingdom is not of this world. This world is passing away. He is a king of a kingdom that is eternal. See, it is Jesus here who is becoming the interrogator. We see this term king called to Jesus very early in the New Testament. In Matthew chapter 2, we see the wise men who came from the east say, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? For we saw his star when it rose and have come to worship him. And this kingship of Jesus Christ brought great controversy during that time period and led Herod in a great expedition to go and to find this Jesus, the king of the Jews. See, but the kingship of Jesus, it can't quite be defined or controlled by those that fear this competition of the rule of Jesus Christ. And it's because the kingship of Jesus Christ is not like the kingship that these earthly kings understand. It is a kingship that exists in a way that is contrary, opposite to the ways in which earthly kingdoms are ruled. D.A. Carson says this. He says, the kingships of this world preserve themselves by force and violence. If Jesus's kingship finds its origin elsewhere, it will not be defined by the world's means. And if it resorts to force and no fighting, it is hard to see how the Romans' interests are in jeopardy. There is a great contrast that exists between the kingdom that Jesus is speaking of and the kingdom of which Pilate is understanding and speaking of. He's almost surprised, like, you're a king? You're a king dressed like this? You're a king being arrested and brought to me? In what way are you a king? He is a man who is confused at this time. It's not fitting into the construct that he understands. R.K. Hughes gives us contrast here between the kingship of Pilate and the kingship of Jesus. He says this, Jesus, the spiritual king, and Pilate as one who is a material king, two completely different approaches to life that are revealed. One who would do anything to receive power, honor, and glory. The other one over here who gave up his glory. One who valued only what he could touch, taste, and feel. And the other who lived and taught that we are not to lay up treasures for ourselves here on earth. One who ruled by material manipulation. And the other that lamented, you are looking for me not because you saw a miraculous sign, but because you ate of loaves that you had and you were filled. One who was arrayed in royal robes. And the other, it is said, had no beauty or majesty to attract us to him. Then on the crucifixion day, life as it appeared, Christ was in control, not Pilate. Jesus is the one who is sovereignly ruling during this time. There's a great contrast that exists between these two men. But one of the greatest contrasts that I see is this of truth and the existence thereof. One who is questioning the existence of truth, questioning most likely how you can be sure what truth even is. Someone who denies truth, someone that falls into relativism will make statements like, well, you can't actually be sure. Or they'll make statements like, you know, there are no absolutes. And such men fall into a quandary where their words end up contradicting themselves because they make an absolute statement to demonstrate their belief that there are no absolutes. So you have the one over here who is questioning the existence of truth, and Jesus over here who is the source of all truth. We have Pilate standing before Jesus Christ, the source of truth, espousing one of the truest statements that could ever be made. And we see Pilate say this. He asks this question, though he makes the statement that is so true, and that is the statement that there is no fault that can be found in this man. There's no fault that can be found in this man. We see that in Matthew 27, 18 and 19. No, you don't. We see that in Luke 23, 4 through 7, sorry. Then Pilate said to the chief priest and the crowds, I find no guilt in this man. But they were urgent in saying, he stirs up the people, teaching throughout Judea, from Galilee, and even to this place. And so he makes this truthful statement, but he's also one who is questioning the existence of truth. He was a man who, although he practiced probably his own form of self-righteousness, he was a man who was very pragmatic. He is also a man who is practicing relativism. He is questioning the existence of truth and justifying his actions that he does because you can't be sure that which is true. I want you to see something, dear friends, that something that is demonstrated within this passage as this follows through to the death of Christ, and something that has been demonstrated within history itself, is that moral relativism leads to tyranny and death. A denial of truth leads to tyranny and death. Man cannot be the epicenter of all truth because he was not made to be the epicenter of all truth. And a man who desires to find truth in and of himself will destroy himself and be destroying the foundation upon which he stands. We see this even in recent history. Friedrich Nietzsche in the early 1900s, who had taught moral relativism at university in Germany, and many generations passed through him and studied under him, and others began to teach likewise, and those began to fill these spots in university, and they taught another generation that came after them, and those grew up and began to sit in the parliament of Germany, sit in the seat of the judge in Germany, and sit even in the presidency of Germany. And those that served in these governing areas practiced these lies, believed the lies of moral relativism, and resulted in these great atrocities that we see that unfolded in the years in World War II. And the Third Reich fell, right? And many of these leaders fled. Many of the military leaders fled to South America. Many of these university scholars, some scientists, others, those that are teaching philosophy, came over to the United States and began to teach such philosophies here within the universities that sit within our borders. And we had a generation that went through and sat under such teaching, with people believing that this was higher thought, this was greater teaching. And we have people that went through and then began to sit in the seat of senator, sit in the seat of a judge, sit even in the seat of a president. And we see the effects of this relativistic philosophy, this moral relativism, and the ways in which it has taught people that man is the epicenter of all truth, that what is true for me might not be true for you, that I can do this particular action here because it's my choice, and for you, it might not be. And you have a society that stands upon the foundation that they are eroding. And we see the effects of that with the decisions that have been made on abortion and the massive loss, the massive death that has occurred because of these relativistic philosophies that were held to. Relativism, dear friend, leads to tyranny. Relativism leads to death. It is of incredible danger when someone holds to that, only in recognizing the truth that exists in Jesus Christ, only in seeing God as the foundation of all truth, can you have a means whereby you can make a right judgment. So we've seen this religion of self-righteousness and the danger that exists there for those that would cling to their own efforts, those that would cling to their own works. We see the dangers here in relativism that we see Pilate practicing. We see Pilate here looking and determining that which is most advantageous, that which is true for him at this time, which will result in tyranny, which is resulting here in mob violence, which will result in the death of an innocent man who is Jesus Christ. And thirdly, we see this religion of pragmatism in John 18, verses 38 through 40. After he had said this, he went back outside to the Jews and told them, "I find no guilt in him, but you have a custom that I should release one man for you at the Passover. So do you want me to release the king of the Jews?" They cried out again, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. Pontius Pilate was the source of much derision for liberal scholars up through the early 20th century. They mocked this idea of Pontius Pilate because as they looked through archaeological sources, they found no Pontius Pilate. I mean, they could have verified his existence in the writings of Josephus or the writings of Philo, or even, granted, the Bible itself, who names his name. Why would they put the name of a man who never existed within these gospels and for him to hold such a prominent position? But even still, many of these mocked this idea, and it wasn't required, but such evidence was found. There was a amphitheater that was excavated, and it was named after Pontius Pilate. And Pilate was a man who normally resided in Caesarea. He was a man who lived in a house that Herod the Great had built. It was an incredible house, which is spoken of very highly in these historical writings. But during the times of a great feast, during the times when there would be a large crowd of people in the area, it was normal for the governor to come into the city, because it was during those times that there was the greatest concern that there would be some kind of a riot or that some kind of violence would break out. And that's what you had during this time period, was a very large group of people that were going through Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover. And as a reminder, the rule of the Romans was something that was extremely, extremely unpopular to the Jews at this time period. And so he was there along with many Roman soldiers to quell any problems that existed. But Pilate was a troubled leader. And it wasn't just that he was a leader in Rome and he ruled over an area that was not happy about Roman rule. Pilate is one that is described this way. D.A. Carson says this. He says, both from biblical and extra-biblical sources, historians have come to know him as a morally weak and vacillating man who, like many of the same breed, tried to hide his flaws under shows of stubbornness and brutality. His rule earned him the loathing of Jewish people, small groups of whom violently protested and were put down with savage ferocity. He was a man who had suffered greatly because of his incompetence as a ruler. This whole scenario with Jesus might have actually turned out differently if Pontius Pilate's job wasn't hanging by a string, but it was. And it was in 36 AD that he ended up being removed from this position of leadership because of his incompetence as a leader. Just to give you a short history of Pilate's troubles and some of the ways in which he chose to rule people, is the first is bringing images of Caesar. It was common to put images of Caesar, who was believed to be a god, up in the cities where you ruled, because this is Rome. And certainly, we're all going to bow down to Caesar, and we are all going to respect Caesar as God, even though they were free to worship other gods, so long as they were not conflicting with Caesar. So as soon as Pilate began to rule in this area of Jerusalem, he began to put up images of Caesar all over the place. And this was an anathema. They were incredibly offended. How could you bring images of a pagan god and put them up here in the holy city? And so they responded by basically doing a sit-in, what you've probably seen some people do for political reasons, to sit in a certain area and just basically get in the way. Thousands of them went around the house of Pilate and just sat down, refused to get up. And after 5 days, Pilate got tired of it and sent soldiers in and declared to them that he would cut off the heads of all who were sitting there. In response, the people there put their head down, willing for them to take even their head, at which time Pilate repented. He took down the images of Caesar. He didn't stop there, though. He took the votive shields, shields that were set aside as something that is made holy in Roman rule. For Caesar, something that is holding some kind of a spiritual worth in their religion, and took them and put them in the holy place, into the temple. And this was an absolute controversy, to which Herod's sons went to Caesar, appealed to Caesar, pleaded with Caesar that these should be removed because it is wrong to have these pagan images within the holy place where the Lord is worshiped. And Caesar ordered him to remove them. He made another error when he needed to build a Roman aqueduct And he desired to bless the people in Jerusalem by building this aqueduct. But the way he chose to build it ended up offending them greatly. And he went into the treasury and he took the money from the treasury that was given for the support of the temple. And he began to build this engineering project. And so they responded by standing around his house again, or standing in large areas in protest of this. And this time he responded differently. He set soldiers in and began to beat upon those people, forcing them to leave. Not something that went over well with the Roman authorities. The Roman authorities desired for there to be peace. It doesn't stop there. He chose to mint coins when he came in to rule, and it seems like he just did one thing after another. Almost every year he had to do something extremely controversial and offensive to the people of Jerusalem, and he minted coins with Caesar's face on one side and then some kind of a pagan deity or pagan symbols on the other side. This resulted in another complaint to Caesar from the people, and those two were removed. And lastly, we have what is in Luke 13:1. It says this, and we have very little information about this, but it says, there were some present at that very time who told him about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. Apparently, there were people doing some kind of a sacrifice at this time, and they were attacked by the brutality of Pilate. But Rome desired peace. It was known as the Pax Romana, and Pilate had failed miserably at keeping peace in his time as governor. His history of pressing Roman customs upon the Jews had led him to a very unwieldy governorship, very much of a roller coaster. And this man, in all of his bravado, in all of his authoritarianism, is a man that I want you to see feared men. He is a man that was very fearful of men. And he's a man who is now in a moral quandary, because he is here and he has Jesus standing in front of him, and he sees no fault. He sees no means whereby a charge can be brought against him. He sees no guilt, no law that he has broken. So he begins to waffle. He begins to say, how is it that I can get out of this? He begins to practice his religion of pragmatism. And we see this in John 18, beginning in 38 there, where he goes back to the Jews and he says to them that I find no guilt in him, but you have a custom that I should release one for you at the Passover. So do you want me to release the king of the Jews? And he's hoping here that he can get something out of this, that perhaps he'll get out of this. He won't have to press the charges on Jesus at this time. And he continues on. We see his confession of the innocence of Christ numerous times in the Gospels. It's in John 19:4. He says, see, I'm bringing him to you that you may know that I find no guilt in him. Now, the irony is that he finds no guilt in him, but he's going to have him beaten, or he has no guilt in him. He finds no guilt in him, but he's going to continue to allow this to proceed in the way that it is. And it is because that he is a man that fears men. The Jews say to him in John 19:12, they say, if you release this man, you are not Caesar's friend. Everyone who makes himself a king opposes Caesar. It's not something that Pilate needs. Pilate knows that if a riot breaks out, Pilate knows that if another controversy breaks out, that he will likely be removed from this position. And the chief priest saying, we have no king but Caesar. What irony that exists there in these men. And we see him continuing to declare him the king of the Jews, placing that even over the cross as it is there. But Pilate is a man, I want you to see, that feared men. He knew the innocence of Jesus. He confessed the innocence of Jesus. He may have said over here what is truth, but he confessed this as something that is true, and he expected the people that heard his words to understand those words in a particular way, because he believed that to be true, and he knew the innocence of Jesus, but he is a man who chose the pragmatic path. He is a man who chose to save his life. contrary to what Jesus calls us to in Matthew 16, verse 25, where he says, "For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? Or what shall a man give in return for his soul?" See, Pilate was clinging to this world. Pilate's hope existed in this world. Pilate's hope existed in that which is material, that which he could taste, that which he could touch, that which he could control in this position that he held as a governor, and he desired to save this life. And it was evidence in 3 years later, him getting removed, that it wasn't even something that he could save. But is it a reminder to all of us that just as Pilate's position is something that was fading away, that he wouldn't continue to hold, this world is something that is fading away. And all of us will die, and we will give an account. And the things of this world that we have will not be that which we take with us. It's a kingdom of this world. It's contrary to the kingdom that Jesus speaks of. We have the Jews here that are likewise working in kind of a relativistic mindset, and they desire just for Jesus to be removed. They're not able to bring proper charges against him. They're not able to convict him, but rather they just want him to be removed. And the way that they see best for this to happen is going to be through a crucifixion, because these are men that know the law, and they know that in Deuteronomy that it says that anyone who hangs from a tree is cursed from God. So how better to remove this Jewish rabbi than to have him placed upon a cross, cursed by God? And so he was. And so he was, as Paul writes in Galatians 3 and verse 13, "Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, becoming a curse for us. For it is written, 'Cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree,' so that in Christ Jesus the blessing of Abraham might come to the Gentiles, so that we might receive the promised Spirit through faith." We see that here, God's sovereignty and how this is even working itself out. Man clinging to his kingdom, man clinging to his religion of self-righteousness, that religion that says, "I can justify myself. I can make myself right before God by one of two ways, either by lowering the bar and looking to someone else and seeing ways in which I don't do what they do, or rather ignoring parts of the law and placing it into categories and emphasizing these things that are outward, emphasizing what I eat, emphasizing where I hang around, emphasizing what I wear, rather than looking at that which is of weightier matter. As the religion of self-righteousness. And the kingdom of Jesus Christ stands contrary to that kingdom, dear friend. Next, we have the kingdom that exists of relativism, and that kingdom that exists where man says that I am the epicenter of all truth, in contrast to God, in contrast to Jesus Christ, that is the source of all truth. Man makes himself that source of truth. And something that I shared with you that I hope that you remember is that it leads to death, and that it leads to tyranny. It is not just something cute that college students go through. It is something that will affect individuals, will affect families, will affect even entire societies, because it stands contrary to the truth of Jesus Christ, and it stands contrary to you, dear friends, as one who is made in the image of God. And lastly, we saw this religion of pragmatism, this religion of man who works in his might to wield a situation, to speak in certain ways, to control an environment whereby he can achieve that which he desires. But that which he is clinging to is that which is passing away, that which will not continue, that which is he will not take with him. As we've said before, when you look at a Hertz, there's never a U-Haul truck on the back of it. But friends, the hope
that we have is not in these religions, not in your ability to justify yourself before a facade of righteousness, not in your ability to make yourself the epicenter of all truth, which you're not, and you know you're not, and you can't live in that world. And also this desire to be pragmatic and to control things for your own purpose. Jesus died so that you don't have to cling to these false religions, so that you don't have to cling to these idols, so that you don't have to have this facade of truth, this facade of righteousness, but rather you can have the righteousness that is in Jesus Christ. As Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 5:21, for our sake, he made him to be sin who knew no sin, that we might become the righteousness of God. And that righteousness of God that we have is Jesus Christ, his righteousness. And also, as Peter says in 1 Peter 2:24, he himself bore our sins in his body on the tree that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds, you have been healed. And by his wounds, we no longer have to trust in these facades of religion, but we can have true religion that is in Jesus Christ, the true righteousness of God, not a facade of righteousness, but rather that is the true righteousness. And in him, you have a hope in a kingdom that is not of this world, a kingdom that is eternal, and a kingdom that, in contrast to this world, is not passing away. Amen. Let's pray.